You're listening to Enthusiasts, a podcast about the most passionate of passionate people. Link in episode description to check out the back catalog, learn more about the show, and check out my other show, 17 Karat K-Pop. This series of episodes tackles themes including depression, suicide, and substance abuse. Please take care when listening, and know the help is out there. Visit NAMI.org, N-A-M-I. Receive more localized support through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 1-800-662-4357. You could also call to talk anytime to a suicide crisis hotline, 1-800-273-8255. Don't want to call? You can text someone. Get 24/7 crisis counselor support, 741-741. Today's story is about simultaneously one very specific thing and everything. So many side characters, so many twists and turns. So it's going to take the unconventional format that my past episodes have about Elon Musk, his worldview evolution, my episodes about the Satanic Panic. Similarly, this time, I want to tell a story that is about a very specific person and view of the world, while adding in so much context that may feel super irrelevant. But just hang in there, all these side stories have a purpose. We are going on a bus ride chronologically through time. So look out the window and see different sideshows as I tell you the main story as your tour guide through this journey of happiness. You'll see, it'll all make sense at the end, but just hang on for this unconventional ride. We are starting the timeline back in the 1950s. Park City, Utah was in dire straits. They had dealt with fires, mine collapses, other big hurdles, but nothing like this before. Financially, they were just devastated, especially after, for the first time, their typical loan approval got rejected. And it had this cyclical effect. Less money, less investment in the community, less resources, so more people move away, then you have less money, less taxpayers, less investment, more people move away, a doom loop. It was basically triggered because it was a mining town and the price of metal collapsed. It even made it on a list of ghost towns, so it was officially dubbed a ghost town, despite some people still living there. The residents got such a bad rep too. They had this renegade reputation in this mining town. So externally, people stereotyped them, treated them hostily. And in the mid-50s, 10 of them were arrested after this law enforcement raid on Main Street, where they said they had to clean up the nefarious town. So Main Street pretty much boarded up. Teachers left. School enrollment in this already super small town went from a class of 69 to a class size of 20. There were city worker layoffs. One fire truck for the place, one school bus, one snowplow. Clubs had to raise money for road repairs. On the flip side, it did help the community really feel strong and emboldened as a collective. Those tough times really brought them closer, more proud of and defensive of their Park City identity. They all rolled up their sleeves and saw each other's fellow humanity, saw themselves as working towards the same goals. So they all pitched in, they donated material, time, and money to all sorts of city cleanup projects to beautify the city, clear out vacant lots, reconstruct, repave, etc. They took a revitalization into their own hands. Even doing things like hand-making a big Visit Park City handmade billboard that was put up by the highway. And they made do with what they had for pleasure as well as work. 4-H clubs taught kids all sorts of life skills. They had big community dinners, dances, games. With little resources, they still tried to make holidays and other special occasions super fun for the kids. Like in the winter, they had coasting lanes where you could basically sled, ride a sleigh to school or whatever. They had a weekly paper and a phone operator who would connect them to who they wanted to call. The phone operators basically knew all the gossip, so they had some fun banter connections with those workers. So super close-knit town that made the most of a bad time. And then became unrecognizable after 1963. The tourism is what saved the town. They set up the Treasure Mountain Ski Resort, eventually renamed the Park City Mountain Resort. And now, Park City is a big tourism hotspot and a pretty wealthy place that hosts big-name events like the Sundance Film Fest. Lots of annual summits and speeches are in Utah now, viewed as the special dreaming big, pitching big ideas, trying big things, putting yourself out there, creative, bold, place of opportunity. A few years before the 70s, an influential book that shaped the thinking of the 70s came out. In 1967, The Ghost in the Machine was published. It's a philosophical, psychological book by Arthur Koestler. It basically breaks down the mind-body connections, shows that your mind and body do have relations to each other. And the book describes people as holons, like humans are holons, part of a bigger whole, autonomous, self-organizing units that also contribute to part of one bigger picture. So it became a bigger way to look at the world, not just in one context. So the term holacracy became a type of go-to for a style of management that basically roughly translates to management by everyone. So companies that tried holacracy were trying basically an anti-bureaucracy, getting rid of red tape and just making sure power was distributed horizontally more than vertically. So titles like supervisor and boss were done away with. You were your own boss, as was everyone else. All of you independent holons contributing to company-wide goals or subgroup goals. A lot of typical workplace vocab was swapped out with this branding. Like, you weren't doing your job, you were energizing a role. You didn't have rules, you followed policies, starting with the Holocratic Constitution. And the first step of implementing a Holocratic Constitution is relinquishing your power. Anyone in authority voluntarily says, "I'm giving it up." When you address problems at team meetings, you don't just have a boss strike down an idea or boost it up. You go in a circle, you do rounds. Every person talks and raises tensions. The problems, the issues they have, those are called tensions. And the people who deal with those tensions in different capacities and to help as a liaison to different subunits, subcircles, those are the links, like a lead link. Without rules, holacracy is basically letting issues go until they're an issue. Like, if it's not an issue at first, then you can assume it's allowed until someone raises attention about it. You might be thinking, isn't this just bureaucracy with different language? Like, still, surely, there is kind of a hierarchy here. Well, yes and no. It's built kind of as a hierarchy of work, not a hierarchy of people, of workers. So you're working on prioritizing importance of goals and assignments, not importance of person to report to. It's also different in terms of how norms are established, not by who's in charge, but by group meetings, a democratic somewhat governing process. Those who like this model argue a couple things. One, get rid of the bureaucracy, way more productive. Two, it's more empowering if each worker feels like an essential piece of the puzzle, not just a cog in a nameless machine, nameless at their level. Three, overall, more equal distribution of power pays off because junior employees might actually notice more defects, more holes in a proposed solution than an older, higher succession person. People who have been at the company longer, they could just brush off more stuff as normal to them. So fresh eyes could actually be more beneficial if their reports were taken more seriously. So it adds to employee morale, a sense of fairness, a sense of we're all in this together. It's also great for conflict-averse bosses. You're self-managing. And it's malleable. Constantly in flux, roles can change to accommodate the times. John Bunch described it as like a jungle gym over a ladder. Like, jobs you're not working through up the ladder status-wise. You're playing on the jungle gym status-wise. So as times change, the organization can evolve. You don't have to feel like it's a time where you're stuck on one run of a ladder. Any time you could raise attention, argue for a different role, and have a meeting to process that idea for how to change your role. Opponents argue that these pros are actually cons as well. They bring their own issues. Like, first of all, if it's a good system for conflict-avoidant bosses, maybe it's kind of a bad system because they get off the hook. Who's accountable when things go wrong if there is no higher-up? Who does the buck stop with? It's a way for people to kind of shirk responsibility. So when they do give up their superior authority, they also give up some of the responsibilities that they assume they will have to answer to. So then opponents argue it's actually less productive because there's not a clear leader saying, all right, here are the tasks for the day. We've got this clear agenda. Instead, your agenda is set by a big group collectively, which involves a lot of going around the room, having everyone equally speak. So that process takes quite a while. Also, when no one is checking up on you as a supervisor, it forces people who might not be good at just self-control, self-policing, to stay on task, and it allows bad actors to exploit the system. Lastly, some argue, yeah, junior employees might raise red flags that more senior employees don't, but that could just be ignorance. Like, if a junior employee says, hey, this is an issue, and it's not, that's just the normal function, under Holacracy, you would have to waste time in a meeting addressing the tension they raised. Whereas typically, you could just dismiss them, say don't mind them. It's a double-edged sword. So in the 70s, some big-name companies tried Holacracy. And now, over 300 have. Shell Oil, Cummins, Medium, the co-founder of Twitter, Evan Williams, vouched for it. So over the decades, it has stayed not obscure. However, the concrete evidence that Holacracies work long-term, or are even better, more productive in material ways than non-Holacracies, lacking. And quite a few organizations have tried it, but given up after a few years, saying it just wasn't working. It sounds freeing and empowering, and it can be. But for some people, they really don't want to be their own boss. They want to be told what to do. They don't want to feel like you're on your own. We will move on in a minute, but I do just want to breeze through the Holacracy Constitution. I'm fascinated by it, so I'll give you the SparkNotes version. The first part talks about the energizing roles for each employee. Each role needs a purpose, a domain, and accountabilities attached to it. Each person is the partner, so your partners each have a role and responsibilities. The responsibilities include next actions, which is what you should do right now, and projects, which are longer-term to-dos. You're allowed to act on next actions whenever, but you aren't allowed to do stuff that causes a material impact outside of your domain. And the domain delegation is limited based on circles. Each circle has a lead link, and the governance process has a lead link as well as a rep link and a cross link. Plus the elected roles, facilitator, secretary, then the rep link. If a circle gets bigger, it becomes a super circle, and the smaller circle is now a sub-circle. They are welcome to have a cross-link policy that allows circle overlap in some forms. So now it's a linked entity and is called a target circle. Yeah, there's a lot of relabeling as this thing changes. A similar organization structure was popular in the 70s called sociocracy. And this experimentation was similar in how it sought to replace bureaucracy, but different in that it focused more on the interconnectedness of those circles. It was also called dynamic self-governance. The sociocratic circle method is what they're talking about. Some nonprofits and co-ops to this day enjoy a sociocratic method. 1979, MIT professor Philip Clay is behind one of the first ever comprehensive gentrification studies that sums up what gentrification is and its impacts in four phases. Part one, there's the arrival of artists, seeking cheaper housing or a safe space from past environments where they did not feel welcome, people in search of a home. Part two, decrease in property values, increase in foot traffic, increase in middle-income residents. Basically, it becomes more livable. Part three, big aesthetic makeovers and improvements that reflect the preferences of the new, wealthier residents. Then phase four, the OG artists who made that place their own get priced out of the market they helped revive. So those were the big takeaways. Keep those in mind, but now we're talking about raves and nitrous oxide. Moving on to the 80s and 90s. We have to talk about that. And this philosopher and psychologist, William James, who loved experimenting on himself with nitrous oxide and writing down the grand visions and eureka moments that came to mind when he was under that influence. He claimed certain philosophical, deep thinking required, heavy concepts were just not decipherable to him until he was under the influence. Then suddenly he was like, aha, I understand everything. He actually set up the first experimental psych lab in Harvard's history, despite the fact he claimed to kind of doubt the legitimacy of treating psychology as a science at all. Now, this is what he said. I am not saying that. But, quote, "This is no science. It is only the hope of science," unquote. He wrote a piece called Subjective Effects of Nitrous Oxide, which has a headache-inducing amount of grammar errors, but I plowed through it so you don't have to. He basically finds a very wordy, rambling way to get his message across that this nitrous oxide gave him this wonderful feeling, clarity, and he really encouraged others to try it out. He also said it basically made him see how all things are one, how different things in the world are connected, how things are infinite, exist forever, matter, pieces of matter in the world that isn't created or destroyed. He described how everything means nothing, and nothing means everything, which if you really get deep into it, yeah, that's not technically wrong. Outside of the philosophizing, the way he put it was not persuasive. He doesn't sound authoritative. He wrote things like, quote, "What's mistake but a kind of take? What's nausea but a kind of ausia? Sober, drunk, unk, astonishment. Everything can become the subject of criticism. Agreement, disagreement. Emotion, motion. How that hurts, how it doesn't hurt. Reconciliation of two extremes." That sounds like nonsense, but it is pure nonsense. Medical school. Divinity school. 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 Unquote. But in the 80s and 90s, truly, nitrous oxide was a big thing. People were really seeing how they could get high on it. Balloons, pacifiers, whatever mode they could find. There was even a nitrous oxide PlayStation game back in 98. That's how popular it was as this big cultural thing. It also led to casualties. Like in 92, three people in LA died in a pickup truck because they were huffing nitrous oxide out of these balloons and left the tank open. In 1984, the Rajneeshi bioterror attack occurred, where followers of this commune under Rajneesh wanted to tilt an election in their favor by subterfuge. And they wanted not just political power, but retaliation for this rejection of a building permit. They had increasingly faced hostility when they tried to set up camp in Wasco County. They were not welcome. They were ticked off about it. So they tried to basically kill voters and intentionally spread salmonella. It was actually the largest bioterror attack in U.S. history. They acquired from a medical supply company salmonella. They poured it in salad bars and salad dressing bottles across restaurants in the area. They also poured it into some notable figures' water glasses and tried to spread it via urinals and doorknobs. Victims of this ranged from an infant to an 87-year-old. 751 people were infected. 45 had to be hospitalized, but luckily no one died. They even planned to infect the whole town water supply. So the salmonella was just like a trial run, part one. They did not make it to part two. But also part of part one was this Operation Share a Home, where they wanted to bring in a bunch of homeless people to register to vote there, dilute voting power. Although 8 Rajneesh Param followers were responsible, only 2 were convicted on attempted murder. Their leader, Rajneesh, emerged in the fall of 85, basically saying, "Whoa, I've been in self-imposed exile for years. What'd I miss? Oh my gosh, they did that? I had no idea. That's terrible. People went rogue. They're not part of my group." After a search warrant was issued, people did look into this commune, and they found lots of stuff in the lab, including explosive-making material and a dentist office. Yes, in the commune, there was a famous dentist office where Rajneesh would try to see what happens under the influence of nitrous oxide. And his ramblings while high were published in a set of 3 books, called Notes of a Madman, Books I Have Loved, and Glimpses of a Golden Childhood. This dentist office was dubbed Noah's Ark because it would flood around the area, so he would be isolated in this dental room for long periods of time. And if you were curious, the plot did backfire. The election was not won by this commune's pick, who they actually ended up just withdrawing. The backlash was so swift, the plan backfired so much, people turned out in droves for the other candidates to really just once and for all kick out this group. In the mid-80s, Burning Man originated. The Burning Man Festival, founded at Baker Beach in San Francisco, it's a festival to this day, but at first it was quite quaint. Now it's in Nevada every year, and is so much bigger. Still dubbed as kind of a countercultural force, embracing 10 key principles, including radical inclusion, leaving no trace after the 2 weeks in the desert, immediacy, decommodification, radical self-expression. So it still has those values and ideas to be a festival dubbed countercultural, going against social expectations. However, it's gotten so big, it's also ironically kind of mainstream. But what's not is still their tradition of burning a work of art. They burn a man, a sculpture of sorts, at the end of the festival. Now let's go to 1999. Two major things were happening in the late 90s in San Francisco. Rave culture and the dot-com bubble. The rave scene was popping off. People had private listservs, and so they could get, via calling a phone number, they'd get an update about where the secret rave was going to be that night. It was a fun underground counterculture thing. Plus, the flyers got a boost with Photoshop being invented in 89. The raves were just this big moment for house music, community, letting your inner freak fly. They embodied PLUR, peace, love, unity, and respect, a term coined by DJ Frankie Bones. So at a time when the internet was really proving to be a worldwide changing, powerful force, and suddenly possibilities seemed so endless. The world is your oyster. What inventions will we come up with next? That jovial spirit matched with a time to party spirit, which was also special because this was pre-social media, so you really could have fun secret hangouts. That also felt more niche because, like, it wasn't the producer DJ mainstream festival scene we have today. The rave scene was a big hit out west because of the wealthy Silicon Valley people who could afford to put on big bashes, as well as the fact the latest big party drugs were manufactured out west. So they got, like, first dibs. Tech companies loved throwing parties, drugs or not. Cannot stress enough how big these parties were. Yeah, tech parties took place before they were so flush with cash, but those were much more proper, suit and tie, boring gatherings. This was not formal. This was huge, literally hundreds or thousands on a guest list. Lots of freeloaders snuck in, but no one really cared. A place called the Bubble Lounge booked as many as 3 parties per night. On any given week, Bay Area tech companies threw about 15 to 20 parties. On average a week, 15 to 20. Each one costing on average 30 to 50K. And actually, one restaurant called Foreign Cinema had a no parties if it's less than 30K policy. Salesforce threw a 15,000 person guest list party the same night as their competition on purpose. The competition had a convention, so instead, at the same time, they had this big B-52's performance and actors perform this piece trapped in cages. They also aired footage of a manufactured anti-software protest. And if you thought that was extra, if you had gone to Luminate's party, you would have seen 3-foot-tall cheese blocks. Others had Cirque du Soleil, they had big, famous musical acts, they had some original, not copied, works of famous art. The San Francisco Museum of Modern Art hosted 105 functions 1 year, where 38 of them were paid for by web companies. Besides just having fun, these were good events for networking, for both employees and employers to find each other pre-LinkedIn. It was definitely not going to last, though, not just because of fatigue, but because the benefits, the tangible benefits, didn't really present themselves. There have not been any big reports or studies showing a clear connection, like if you spend more lavishly on a special party, you get more paying customers. Revenue after your name recognition spreads at a party, not really a clear correlation. Especially with all the freeloaders not going, even knowing, like, yeah, we just crashed the Salesforce party. You're just like, yeah, we crashed the Cirque du Soleil party. In 94, Jerry Yang co-founded Yahoo, a word he decided to pick from Gulliver's Travels, referring to an uncouth and uncivilized being. That free man spirit, a bit of a hippie rebel view, was part of Google, too. Google Doodle was out for the first time in 98, and the first ever Google Doodle was a nod to Burning Man. Backing up a bit, let's talk about the early years of a fascinating figure, Tony Hsieh. What you need to know about him, first, he's a very non-confrontational person, very conflict-averse, doesn't like to confront people, often just, when he has something he wants to get across, he'll recommend a book or a TED Talk and say, go check that out, and that talks for him. He's also very analytical, so he really is tech-savvy and ready to observe a situation and figure out, like it's a puzzle to crack, how to deal with it. So he studied stuff that might come naturally to others. Public speaking, comedy as an art form. He really wanted to study, learn as much as he could, compile the data in his head, and then apply it. He disclosed to some people that he thought he was on the autism spectrum, but was never officially diagnosed. I am autistic, and that will shape how I view him for sure. Because before I read that part of one of the books about his life, so before I kind of knew officially he was autistic, I knew. My radar went off. We are kindred spirits in many ways. So I do see his story through a unique lens that we will talk about more as this story goes on. But that did affect his life and how he viewed the world as kind of a puzzle, as something you could just kind of coldly analyze and crack. Yet at the same time, wanting to do so to crack a code of emotions, figuring out how to quantify and tap into qualitative stuff like joy. So he thought abstractly too. He was a Buddhist, as are actually many tech visionaries, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg. They at least adopt Buddhist principles. And he wanted to make everyone around him happy. So he was shy, socially awkward, but always throwing parties, always bringing people together, having social gatherings, because he wanted to watch, like a bystander, see other people having fun. So he'd always go to the door, this is so me, instead of socializing at a party, he would just go to the door to have something to do, but not talk to people. That's what I think he was doing, really. But what he did was, even if it was hours of saying hi to people at the door, he would just stand there. And he liked to watch. He did not like parties, but he liked to throw them to people watch. I'm the same way with everything, in that I feel like, going through the world of neurotypical people, I am kind of an outsider. And I don't mind. I often just like being on the periphery, not confronting anyone, minding my own business, but really watching with fascination how people interact and go through this life. So anyway, he was very curious, a character you'll meet who's quite curious, but a critical thinker, and always wants to let out his inner child, which is another very autistic tendency, which I support. We often don't lose sight of our inner child like people who are neurotypical do, because we never conform as much to social norms and expectations of what we should or shouldn't grow out of. He also reminds me of myself, because he would like to be around big things, but alone in that crowd. Not just with parties, but like, he liked theater, but as a tech person. He liked what game creators did. He was paid to test the games. I'm kind of the same way, where I'm so scared of being seen, and it's kind of a shock to the system if you go through life not being seen, being ignored. So it's more comfortable to feel like I could be seen if I wanted to. Like, I like live theater. I like the feeling of being near a stage, but not the one everyone's looking at on stage. Similarly to him, I want to make a big impact, but I also kind of don't. I don't mind anonymity in it. Tony Hsieh was quite a standout elementary school student. He liked to challenge himself intentionally. When a task was, hey, write a sonnet for homework, he did so in Morse code. He also wrote remarkable poetry. Truly, I love this so much. I wrote it down. I'm keeping it. It was in a book about him, which I will link to on my site. Go read it. It is so good. This poem floored me. It's like a riddle. Okay, ready? This is what a middle school-aged Tony Hsieh wrote, so try to figure out what he's talking about. 28 white men, standing nice and straight. 4 more to be hatched, but many years to wait. Some might become knights and wear a silver suit. Others might wear a gold outfit, recover their stolen loot. But the silver and gold people are all very rich, only because an enemy came and dug a little ditch. The people crash against each other, crushing everything in between. They often get awfully dirty, so it's best to keep them clean. Every half a year, they should visit a friendly man. Sometimes one is removed and thrown in a garbage can. They neither walk nor drive a car. Now try to guess what these people are. You ready? I'm about to spoil it. teeth. He's talking about teeth. 28 white men standing nice and straight. 4 more to be hatched. Many years to wait. Silver suit, gold suit, digging a ditch. Every half year they should visit the dentist. The people crash against each other, crushing everything in between. They often get awfully dirty, so it's best to keep them clean. So yeah, this was a very brilliant young boy in middle school. That did not mean he was having a blast. In fact, he missed his last dance of 8th grade because he was taking the SAT. Yeah, he had big, high expectations. There was some cultural context there too, with his parents being Taiwanese immigrants. They really tried to set him up for academic success, and that was a big goal of theirs. So he got to go to a very expensive private school for high school called Branson. His parents were very emotionally present as well, though. On family vacations, his mom, Judy, used to have one-on-one time with him and his two brothers. So they each had an hour designated for them to open up to her. But Tony never really wanted to. He kind of just found it awkward. Tony was quite a businessman before he went to college. He did so many entrepreneurial pursuits. He tried to sell Christmas cards in summer. That didn't work out. He tried to start a worm farm and thought it would be a good idea to put yolk, like egg yolk, on them to grow more. Birds found it. There were no worms to be sold. He thought kind of cleverly about it, though, choosing a worm farm because he heard worms regenerate. So he figured, hey, for the price of one batch, I get 2 batches of worms if I cut them in half. For a young kid, that's pretty clever logic. The egg yolk part, not so much, but anyway. He then tried to sell his own newspaper, The Gobbler, and he ran a personal button-making business that his brother Andy helped with. The money from the buttons, he wanted to go to his mom's patients. The San Rafael News wrote an article about him in 1987 with the headline, "Local Boy Has Got What It Takes." Tony then went to Harvard, where he fell in love with his trips to New York. He loved New York. He was fascinated with the way that school and city life were blurred. Where you could have fun, recreation, and where you studied were so intermixed. Like, they were just all in the same vicinity. With an endless supply around you then of creativity, friendships, people watching, things to take in and analyze to try to feel like you better understand the world. He loved what a city had to offer. So that stuck with him and he thought about that. He also made friends everywhere. He scanned and made copies of a handwritten note to buddies at Harvard before they left for winter break, which is really sweet. It said, quote, "Something I want to say to all of you. A little over 3 months ago, we hadn't even met. Call it luck, call it fate, whatever brought us together, I feel very lucky to have you all as such good friends. Quite simply, you guys light up my life. Without you guys, I wouldn't be anywhere near as happy with college as I am now. I hope that each of you invites me to your wedding, because I want to be there when the people dearest to me are having one of the happiest days of their lives," unquote. He says in that note, both, "Thank you guys for making me happy, and please let me see you happy in return." I also feel very seen that he put his feelings in writing. Saying stuff like the venting session opportunities with his mom, that's not really our cup of tea. We prefer to be speaking little and doing much, and writing much often. Articulating our feelings vocally, usually not as easy, at least in my case, as just writing it. A really smart, clever business tactic was used in Tony's second half of college. Harvard had a Quincy House Grill, this housing dorm that worked as a restaurant. So college students, often seniors, would be hired to run this grill out of Quincy House. But Tony decided to try to take the job as a junior. He figured if he was bold with a makeover for this business, he might have a bigger financial risk, but more time to pay it off to compensate for a loss if he started as a junior. So he bet the highest by $1 and won the job. He was in business with Sanjay and Alfred. What he would do is he would take the subway to McDonald's, buy burgers for $1 each, then sell them back at Quincy House for $3 each. They eventually switched, though, finding pizza more profitable. They spent $2,000 on a pizza oven. They also got money from a friend of Tony's, whose mom is a TV producer in Taiwan. They used her investment to buy a TV. Remember, this is before, like, TiVo. And Tony decided he would record episodes of the popular show Melrose Place and record some MTV music videos. So the next day, they would have playing, with fast-forwarded commercials, that popular stuff in the Quincy House Grill. So they made it quite a happening hangout spot. It was not as lucrative as he may have envisioned, though. One, because there was a burglary. And two, Tony found out Alfred was behind his back, kind of making his own money, because every night he would order a large pizza for himself. Then it turns out he would go sell it by the slice to his upstairs dorm neighbors. In May of 95, Tony started what might have been like one of the first digital study groups ever. There was a Harvard Crimson article about this called Senior Forum's Bible Study Group on Net. This brings to mind kind of his antics when he was younger and would skirt around doing something. Like, he would play a recording of the piano instead of piano lessons. So his parents thought he was rehearsing every day, but he wasn't. Things like that. He found ways to not do work that didn't interest him. Similarly, he didn't care for this Bible study class. So when he found out there was a big test with a ton of prep questions to go over, he decided, hey, what if I get a group of people online to each call dibs on a couple of these questions? Then we pool our answers so that we don't have to all study all of this. We learn from each other, and I will compile all the answers, then sell people the study guide. Out of 1,200 students in that course, only 40 participated. But later, many others who talked to the school paper said, if I had known, I would have joined. Some of them also said they wanted to, but they worried it was against the rules. But the teachers interviewed had no problem with it. They were like, studying is studying. He found a new way to do it. The article ends with quite a foreshadowing. Comments about this cyberspace-oriented study group might be the new normal. Tony graduated in the spring of 95, and he made a bet with his friends. If he became a millionaire within the next decade, he would foot the bill when they went on a big group cruise together. If he didn't become a millionaire within 10 years, they'd still go on a cruise, but they would pay for it. They'd pool money for it. He figured it was a win-win, because either he would be a millionaire or he would get a cruise. Quote, either way, I would be happy, unquote. After getting a degree in computer science, he briefly ran something called Internet Market Solutions, but he quickly lost interest. Then he was hired quickly for Oracle, working for Larry Ellison of Silicon Valley venture capital fame. Tony got into the tech world at an interesting time, because in 95, only about 3% of the US used the internet, but it was on the big precipice of taking over the world. When Netscape went public, stock demand was so high, trading was delayed 2 hours. And Oracle ended up bringing in $2 billion in annual revenue. So Larry Ellison got a nice fancy schmancy headquarters nicknamed Larry's Lagoon. Tony did what he now had a habit of doing, and not doing the work that didn't interest him, that wasn't challenging enough, exciting enough for him. He learned that he could do his work for Oracle remotely with them not knowing when he was actually on desk. So he would start to run a software program, go take a nap or something, hours later, clock out digitally, and that was his day. He was quickly restless, though. He was feeling like he wasn't getting joy out of anything exciting. So he had to start something new. He had that itch, that entrepreneurial itch. So against his parents' wishes, he quit his job at Oracle and went on to start a new company with Sanjay of Pizza House fame and Ali Partovi. The group started Link Exchange in the spring of 96. They essentially sold web advertising space, lowering the entry barrier for online advertising back in 96, before this was like a normal thing. This service was very needed for then. With the help of a $200K investment from a childhood friend, they hired about 50 people and moved operations from an apartment to two floors of a building. Tony continued to find clever ways to market stuff. So one way he advertised Link Exchange was asking employees to submit pictures of themselves showing off a creative way they repped the LE logo. So one person sent in a picture of the mowed lawn with the logo in it. Someone shaved their head in that shape. Someone walked through a mall holding a sign for the company and sent him a picture. He made it a fun game, a contest. There's his inner child coming out, mixed with the marketing genius, to see who could advertise Link Exchange the best. Then it helped with new hires, because when you walked in for an interview, you saw a fun photo-covered wall of that contest, which may have helped soften up people's stance toward the company when they also might have seen sleeping bags under desks, because they worked a lot. They saved money on office space because they would have these desks by these doors without knobs. They bought a bunch of doors, and instead of knobs, the computer cables could run through the holes, so the computers could lean up against these walls, all lined up in a row. Tony wanted to keep things very childlike, light and fun and exciting and new. So the work culture reflected that. Not just with those challenges, but the creative ways he wanted people to DIY their desk areas. His area, Monkey's Row, he called it, were cubicles with a jungle theme taking over. He threw spontaneous meetings. He just thought it was fun to make spiffy, well-dressed people do jumping jacks and stuff. It was kind of like an initiation. To work for Link Exchange, you had to prove you didn't take yourself too seriously. There was also an offshoot, Social Club, Drink Exchange, and you didn't have to work for Link Exchange to join. So hundreds would go to these drinking events. The rule was you had to buy two drinks that you gave away to people you don't know. He really loved watching people collide. You'll hear that word a lot as we talk about his businesses. He loved collisions, times where people were brought together that wouldn't normally interact. He loved being the one behind the scenes kind of creating those collision moments. Parties were a big time for that to happen. They promoted it as the event for Wuppies, Web Yuppies. So Wuppie hangouts, fun contests, fun decorated spaces. But still, Tony never wanted the fun to stop. He didn't want to separate work and play. He was inspired by places like New York, where it felt like they blurred together. So he bought up some newly converted residential space in San Francisco and convinced coworkers to move in to the same building with him. Eventually, him and his friends owned 20% of the apartments. It's out of this apartment that they started Venture Frogs. Him and Alfred started an investment group called Venture Frogs. Him and Alfred worked with one other partner too, Sanjay. And the three of them had that holacracy instinct. They didn't want one to be in charge. They moved as a three-person entity with equal power. This Van Ness Avenue penthouse is where Tony would go to host all-nighters. Loved all-nighters. Loft 810 was nicknamed Club Bio after someone misread the sign. Tony later wrote, quote, "We could create our own adult version of a college dorm and build our own community. It was an opportunity for us to create our own world. It was perfect," unquote. Venture Frogs was two parts, really. Venture Frogs, the investment office space stuff, and Venture Frogs, the restaurant, which his parents worked at. Again, a way Tony mixed family and personal life with work to make it all one big blur. And he really did keep the work focus as well. He balanced it. There were times where people thought he was checked out mentally, but he wasn't. Like one time, someone talked to him about this code issue that they wanted fixed. Felt like he didn't listen. We're like, whatever, I'll deal with it tomorrow. Went to work the next day and Tony said, "Is this what you wanted fixed?" And yeah, he had spent the night fixing it. Tony thought about the emotional wants and needs of his employees and kind of cold calculations. Again, a formula, a way of seeing the world as like a math puzzle. How to numerically quantify emotions is what he sought to do with employee well-being. So he would assign point values to goals, basically, and give them a deadline. Another gamification of work. You have until this date to reach that amount of points. They also made sure to put their name out there when they didn't really have the money to do so. There was a big conference in LA called Internet World 97, the place to be for startup networking. Couldn't miss it, so they couldn't afford a booth there, but made their own. Tony drove 6 hours to take a team there, so he brought the staff driving a Winnebago he nicknamed Webabago. Then when they got there, they parked, and in the parking lot, he put a big banner over the Winnebago. The banner had the Link Exchange logo, but that wasn't the only way. They wanted to do some free promo. He also sent out an email blast saying, "Free t-shirts for anyone who comes to our makeshift booth today." And dozens of people turned out for t-shirts, which had the logo too. So they went on to spread the free PR. they had definitely earned some publicity, so it's not surprising some big name potential buyers came knocking. There was the owner of email company Bigfoot, Lenny Barshak. He offered $1 million in cash to buy Link Exchange. They actually counteroffered $2 million so they both could walk away millionaires, which was not accepted. Then Yahoo co-founder Jerry Yang offered $20 million and they turned him down too. He came back later offering $125 million. Long story short, the deal fell through after a peer met with Yang and, presumably while drunk, rambled and acted quite high in his own supply and really turned him off. This guy had also tried to help initiate talks with ViaWeb, who Yahoo then went on to buy. So, two in one blow, basically. But Yang was still very impressed by them, especially after meeting Tony, who thought to say, "Congrats, I heard you got married recently." Then Michael Moritz, journalist turned venture capitalist, invested $3 million in Link Exchange. Tony did that thing that would become his routine. He got bored and he wanted the sense of starting something grand and new again. He realized he had been starting to hit the snooze button in the mornings again, which was like an indicator of getting bored. He hadn't hit the snooze button that much since his time at Oracle. So he realized he was restless. There was also kind of a culture clash with the new CEO who didn't really click with Tony's much younger crew. Their juvenile at times risk-taking was not really compatible. So the nature of it was changing, but Tony wasn't. So it was time to leave. In 1998, at just age 24, Tony Hsieh sold Link Exchange to Microsoft for $265 million. And he would have gotten 20% more if he had stuck to a proposed Microsoft agreement they had initiated for a year, but he didn't want that time stipulation. He made a rather uncommon request in the negotiating period for more of the lead's equity to go back to employees with less stock. Naturally, not everyone liked that he wanted to spread the money more like that, but he did. Anyway, Michael Moritz was a part of Link Exchange after his initial investment. And he sent out a message to employees after the sale, quote, "You are now free to let your imagination roam," unquote. Moritz, when he was recruited, he had to do the Macarena as part of his initiation. So after being what could be a big, now big-headed, big-shot millionaire at 24, instead, Tony went back to being classic Tony. And he just had fun times where he wanted to go on adventures with friends and watch them be happy. So he had this fun camping trip flop in 98. He took his friends camping, got them all mini tents for it, only to realize that meant he had bought a bunch of kid-sized tents. So they got there and they had to sleep in the car. That was Tony for you. He wanted to just go on adventures. All hours of the day and night, he might say, "Hey, want to go on a walk? Want to go play a game?" etc. Lots of big, life-changing moments were in store for Tony in 1999. Which converged with that rave scene and dot-com party scene and drug scene we talked about earlier. Tony went to his first warehouse rave and took MDMA for the first time. He was transformed. And as an autistic person, I continue to see myself in Tony with his reaction to music. I feel him as he writes about in his book the transformative feeling of going from feeling like you orbit the outskirts of the world to being pulled into the fold and you're part of just one big mobile, unison, hive mind, in sync with the music organism. The way music realigns my scrambled neurons, not the technical way to put it, but that's how I describe it, it is incredible. Music on the autistic brain, don't underestimate it. So he writes about that feeling and the euphoria of it. So he fell in love with that rave scene. The part I don't relate to is the MDMA part. The hardest drug I've tried is coffee, but I digress. He loved that sense of everyone together. He also liked how drugs loosened him up because he was so socially anxious. And this is a classic autistic trait. A lot of classic autistic traits he has that seem obvious if you are autistic. Like, yep, that's what we do. And one of those is he's mirroring people around him. So when he's at these big social party scenes, he's mimicking, he's mirroring social people. Now that also means you can end up being manipulated and taken advantage of with your naivete. That year, Tony became a big first investor in DanceSafe after meeting the founder, Emmanuel Sverios. DanceSafe was an idea for an ecstasy detector, and Tony wrote him a $25,000 check on the spot. DanceSafe went on to spread with training seminars nationwide, and Tony helped kickstart that. So Link Exchange, Oracle, Venture Frogs, Tony was once again ready for something new. Which is when he got a call from Nick Swinmurne. Nick was a marketing manager who pitched him an idea. Tony was now a pretty notable name among VC circles, venture capitalists, and Nick was hoping Tony would help fund his idea. So he pitched him, "What if we sold shoes online? Shoesite.com, let's do it." Tony was skeptical. Why would anyone buy shoes online? That's the kind of thing you need to physically try on before ordering. But eventually Nick convinced him, look, this is a pretty safe market to try. People will always have demand for shoes. It's a big industry with a giant audience. We don't have to worry about a niche demographic here. So Tony said, let's do it, but let's rename it. Because in the future, we may want to expand out of shoes. So instead of shoesite.com, they went with Zappos, which was a play on the Spanish word for shoes, zapatos. Ironically, Tony was into this new adventure for the fun, really. At least not for the shoes. He barely showed any interest in shoes and kind of enjoyed going barefoot. He also was super informal, famously only owned one suit, and that was a co-ownership thing with his brother. One more anecdote from 1999. The Cirque Lodge was founded. This wellness center in Park City, Utah, eventually became a rehabilitation center for many famous and wealthy clients. Over the years, he's turned down multiple offers from private equity firms to buy the Cirque Lodge. It stayed in the OG owner's hands, and many of the staff never left. A very consistent, principled staff who, directly and indirectly, have a lot of empathy for struggling with addiction. So they've been with the business since day one. And it now kind of mixes a mix of classic 12-step programming with more spirituality-focused, experimental therapies. So you might be seeing now Park City, Utah, revitalization projects and their effects, drugs, the rave scene, the venture capital world, the tech boom. You might be seeing the pieces kind of getting closer together now. Hang in there. Now let's talk about Zappos' early years. Let's pause here and get ready for the next chapter of this story, coming very soon. Be sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it.